Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Man, oh man, I need to tweet some things, man. My website's down, so I can't write a blog entry. I'm way behind. This whole time change thing, I don't know how morning people do it. I ain't one. I don't think I'm ever going to turn into one, no matter how long I try. Sheldon Richmond on today, 12 to 3 Eastern. And that's LRN.FM for the Liberty Radio Network. And the thing of it is, you know, part of the delay was I still want to get other people on the show, too. I'm trying to get Eric Margulies right now. I'm waiting to hear back. And then, I'm also going to tweet J.P. Sotilli about his Hillary Clinton article in just a second, but I don't know what all times to ask him to come on yet because I'm still waiting to hear back from Eric. You know what? I should just go ahead and do that. Let's see. Oh, here, I can cut Oliver Stone out of this because I don't care about that. Now I have enough room in there, so 1:30, 2:30 Eastern. The all-important Eastern time zone designation. All right, so yeah, J.P. Sotilli. I really like that guy. He's got this morning email called The News Vandal. You guys should go sign up for it. It's at you can go to his website, newsvandal.com. He writes really good articles, and he's a great writer. He's funny, he's intelligent, he links, like Justin Raimondo, to all of his proof of what he's talking about. And, you know, he's one of these damn liberals or whatever, but that's not what he writes about. What he writes about is the horror of the American empire. And he's really good on it. And so J.P. Sotilli, he's at newsvandal.com, and sign up for his morning email, because he sends out a list of what's going on in the morning that's really worth looking at. And I get buried in those in the morning, but I still try to make time every day. Pretty much every day I make time to read through J.P.'s morning email there. So, again, that's the News Vandal. And he's got one. Is it on anti-war today or tomorrow or what? We got so many goddamn viewpoints to run here. Yeah, he is. He's on antiwar.com today. Hillary Clinton and the weaponization of the State Department. So I just tweeted him, and if I'm lucky, he'll be on the show today as well. And then Eric Margulies is going to be on, and I guess I want to talk with him about Ukraine as well as Syria. Ukraine and Syria. Syria and Ukraine. Eric Margulies, man, he's been around the world more than a few times. He knows the answers to the questions that I have, and I've got a message out to him, and I expect to hear back soon enough. I guess I can't promise Eric Margulies, but I can. Why don't you pencil it in that Eric Margulies is going to be on the show today, the 6th of June, 2014. Unbelievable, isn't it? Hey, you know what? It occurs to me a thing here, and I realize now it occurs to me too late for this segment, but it's the anniversary. Do you remember where you were when you first found out that Glenn Greenwald had published an article which included an entire opinion by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court legalizing a general warrant on all American telephone metadata? Holy crap! Well, it was just Verizon, but we found out from the Wall Street Journal the next day that, oh yeah, everybody else too. You remember where you were? I remember telling the wife, wow, I wonder who's giving this stuff to Glenn. Man, this is something else. And then the Prism theme came out. Oh, man. FTPing your ass off, the NSA is. Got a backdoor right into whatever server they want on all the major services, all the major internet services you can name. Blammo. Right down to your operating system. I thought that NSA key might mean something. Yep, you were right. Oh boy, yeah, I remember. And I remember also, just like Glenn Greenwald describes, he describes in his book, he's described on various interviews in magazines and on TV, that he assumed that he was dealing with a senior level, you know, silver-haired, 60-something-year-old NSA supervisor who's made his career there and has now just, you know, is so fed up and it's basically, you know, amounts to his deathbed confession kind of thing. I'm on my way out. I don't care if they imprison me. Damn it. I'm going to go ahead and leak all this stuff. That's what I thought, too. That's what I assumed, too. In fact, I guess I assumed it must be more than one. But I was thinking, wow, this is like, this is high-level sources. And then I remember being pleasantly surprised to find out all about Edward Snowden when they published the video, the first 12-minute video interview of Edward Snowden, filmed by Laura Poitras right there the first day that they all met there in Hong Kong at the hotel, and where he explains exactly what it is he meant to do by leaking this information. And now there are other clips of Edward Snowden. He's now done some more interviews and talked about some more things, but I think I would like to go back and replay that original clip of Edward Snowden explaining who he is and what he did and why. And I'm not certain why, but I keep seeing Ed Norton's picture up next to stories about the Ed Snowden, Glenn Greenwald movie coming out. And I'm thinking, cool. I like Ed Norton, man. He rode my cab one time. He's a nice guy. And I like the movies that he's in, too. Most of the time, seems like. Not that I see that many movies or whatever. I don't know. He may have been in 100 more movies than I've ever seen him in. But anyway. That sounds like a pretty good choice. And anyway. Yeah, I want to find this... I'm going to find that original video. Yeah, here it is. Whistleblower Edward Snowden. I don't want to live in a society that does these sort of things. And of course, what he meant by that was in a society which is ruled by a government which does these sorts of things. But, you know, he dropped out of government school, but apparently too late to make distinctions like that. But, anyway, so... My deal is, I think Ed Snowden's the greatest American hero. I think it's hilarious, actually, now that we're a year out, and thinking back with the hindsight of all the ridiculous conspiracy theories about Edward Snowden, about how he works for the Russians, he works for the Chinese, he's a spy, and he's only laundering his material through Glenn Greenwald and using Glenn Greenwald as a useful idiot because his real plan was to be exiled to Siberia for the rest of his life. Okay, the suburbs of Moscow. It's not quite Siberia, but it still sucks, right? Guy's from Maryland. oh, yeah, no, he's living in a mansion on top of the Kremlin. All of the accusations ring so hollow now, as he explained to Brian Williams the other day. You want a representation of what it is that I took and turned over to the journalists? I think you'll see it in... the stories that have been published, and the documents that have been published so far. That's the kind of stuff he took. And you might have noticed that it's almost all PowerPoint presentations, right? It's almost all NSA presentations from certain groups of officials explaining what it is that they're doing to their bosses or to new trainees and this kind of thing. They have not turned over any kind of specifics about which routers and you know, what code you could use to de-hack them or whatever the hell it is, right? Nothing like that. It's all just general descriptions of the blue bloody murder that they're getting away with. Violating our rights. There should have been 100 more before him. There were about 10, 5. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM. Monday through Friday, noon to 3 Eastern Time. And my website is scotthorton.org, but you can't get there from here, not right now. Well, I don't know. By the time the people listening to the archives hear this, then they will be able to, because or else they wouldn't be able to hear this. So I'm not talking to you people, I'm talking to the live listeners. The website's down. I'm not sure what's broke about it, but it's broken. However, the guy who knows how to fix it, he knows that it's broken, so then that implies that at some point it'll be fixed. So that's good. Anyway, when it works, my website is scotthorton.org, and I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003, if you're into that. And coming up on the show will be the great Sheldon Richman to talk about all kinds of smart things. And then also, I'm working on getting Eric Margolies and J.P. Sotilli, and I think I got a pretty good shot at either or both of those. So that should be good. And now I'm going to play most of this interview with Ed Snowden from a year ago.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii.
What are some of the positions that you held previously within the intelligence community?
I've been a systems engineer, systems administrator, senior advisor for the Central Intelligence Agency, solutions consultant, and a telecommunications information systems officer.
One of the things people are going to be most interested in trying to understand what who you are and what you're thinking is there came some point in time when you crossed this line of thinking about being a whistleblower to making the choice to actually become a whistleblower. Walk people through that decision-making process.
When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee. And because of that, you see things that may be disturbing, but over the course of a normal person's career, you'd only see one or two of these instances. When you see everything, you see them on a more frequent basis, and you recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. And when you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them. But over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up, and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem. Until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
Talk a little bit about how the American surveillance state actually functions. Does it target the actions of Americans?
NSA and the intelligence community in general is focused on getting intelligence wherever it can, by any means possible, that it believes on the grounds of sort of a self-certification that they serve the national interest. Originally, we saw that focus very narrowly tailored as foreign intelligence gathered overseas. Now, increasingly, we see that it's happening domestically. And to do that, the NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them for periods of time, simply because that's the easiest, most efficient, and most valuable way to achieve these ends. So while they may be intending to target someone associated with a foreign government or someone that they suspect of terrorism, they're collecting your communications to do so. Any analyst at any time can target anyone, any selector anywhere. Where those communications will be picked up depends on the range of the sensor networks and the authorities that that analyst is empowered with. Not all analysts have the ability to target everything, but I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
One of the extraordinary parts about this episode is that usually whistleblowers do what they do anonymously and take steps to remain anonymous for as long as they can, which they hope often is forever. You, on the other hand, have decided to do the opposite, which is to declare yourself openly as the person behind these disclosures. Why did you choose to do that?
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures that are outside of the democratic model. When you are subverting the power of government, that's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy. And if you do that in secret consistently, you know, as the government does when it wants to benefit from a secret action that it took, it'll kind of give its officials a mandate to go, hey, you know, tell the press about this thing and that thing, so the public is on our side. But they rarely, if ever, do that when an abuse occurs. That falls to individual citizens, but they're typically maligned. You know, it becomes a thing of these people are against the country, they're against the government, but I'm not. I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
Have you given thought to what it is that the U.S. government's response to your conduct is in terms of what they might say about you, how they might try to depict you, what they might try to do to you?
Yeah, I could be, you know, rendered by the CIA. I could have people come after me or any of their third-party partners. You know, they work closely with a number of other nations. Or, you know, they could pay off the triads or, you know, any of their agents or assets. We've got a CIA station just up the road in the consulate here in Hong Kong, and I'm sure they're going to be very busy for the next week. And that's a fear I'll live under for the rest of my life, however long that happens to be. You can't come forward against the world's most powerful intelligence agencies and be completely free from risk, because they're such powerful adversaries that no one can meaningfully oppose them. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. But at the same time, you have to make a determination about what it is that's important to you. And if living unfreely but comfortably is something you're willing to accept, and I think many of us are, it's the human nature. You can get up every day, you can go to work, you can collect your large paycheck for relatively little work against the public interest and go to sleep at night after watching your shows. But if you realize that that's the world that you helped create, and it's going to get worse with the next generation and the next generation who extend the capabilities of this sort of architecture of oppression, you realize that you might be willing to accept any risk. And it doesn't matter what the outcome is, so long as the public gets to make their own decisions about how that's applied.
All right, y'all. That was some Ed Snowden from a year ago. Happy Snowdenversary. We'll be right back with Sheldon Richmond in just a sec.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is the great Sheldon Richman, Vice President of the Future Freedom Foundation and editor of their journal, The Future of Freedom. Welcome back to the show. Sheldon, how are you?
I'm doing okay, Scott. I'm not hearing you too well, though.
Oh, that's too bad. Here, let me turn up this. How about now? Does that sound a little better?
That is better.
Okay, good.
Yep.
Well, I just needed to adjust a knob. All right. Well, you sound good. So thanks for joining us. You got a couple of articles here. Both of them are really good and worth talking about. But so let's start with the first one first. Sergeant Bergdahl and the Fog of War. I'm interested to know what you think of, well, this whole scandal, such as it is anyway.
Well, in the, what I tried to do in that piece was to show that war is filled with confusion, not only of a knowledge kind. The fog of war, I think, typically refers to it's just hard to get information when in the thick of things. But I think there's also a moral fog for a lot of people because people are ordered to shoot other people they don't know and may not have any particular beef with, simply on order. And, there's a lot of moral ambiguity always. Innocents are killed, but that's cold, given the sterile label, collateral damage. And, I'm not saying anything that's terribly startling there. I think everybody understands that.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be surprised when someone has a crisis of confidence and maybe goes over there gung-ho, as apparently Bergdahl did and was for quite a while, according to his colleagues in his unit, and then decides that things aren't what he thought they were or as they were represented to him, and then has a crisis of confidence and does something that doesn't conform to the romantic war movies. I was writing this at a time before we didn't know a whole lot about the circumstances surrounding Bergdahl's disappearance and then captivity. And so I didn't go into a lot of description because we simply didn't know it. We know more today than we did when I wrote that back on Monday, I guess, or Monday and Tuesday. So that's what I was trying to say, that we shouldn't be surprised when someone has a crisis of confidence and does something that other people look askance at, including even leaving the unit altogether. I wasn't defending it. I wasn't defending any particular thing he may have done because, first of all, I didn't know what he did. But I was trying to say that we shouldn't be surprised when someone has a moral crisis volunteering to be in a war.
Right. Well, one of the most notable things about it, right, is obviously the Republicans have decided this is their new Benghazi scandal or whatever. So there's everything that goes along with that. But even just the twisted narrative because this is still a U.S. soldier, a white kid from Idaho, and they, TV media, they want to be somewhat biased towards him or some. It's hard to, they're a little bit divided in their own minds about what they're supposed to think about this guy. And so I've heard them refer to his mental illness over and over and over again, that apparently, he snapped, he went haywire, he went crazy, he lost his mind. Doesn't this sound to you like it must have been some kind of psychotic break or some kind of, he was over, his senses and emotions and thinking processes were overwhelmed by the madness or, this kind of thing where, it's sort of like what you're saying, the pressure got to him, but the way that they say it, they phrase it in such a way as to deny him agency. I guess if someone I'm supposed to love this much could do something I'm supposed to hate that much, then it must be because, some insane part of his brain took over or something like that,
Well, as soon as I hear mental health explanations or illness explanations for people's behavior, I bar the door, make sure I have my wallet, and then I wait for it to blow over. And to me, it's totally unhelpful. It doesn't explain anything, whether it's a mass killer like that guy in, you know, wherever the last shooting was, Santa Barbara or someplace, or this. I mean, there's no help whatsoever talking about psychological. I don't mean psychological explanations. We can talk about human motivation, but you're right. As soon as you take agency out of it and start talking about insanity or mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, there's really such a thing as schizophrenia, where people are completely out of their mind and can't tell the difference between what's real and what's their hallucinations.
Now, that's a whole other conversation.
But there's no indication that that's what we're talking about here, right?
I am a fan, student, and was a friend of Dr. Thomas Sass. So that's a whole other discussion whether schizophrenia is really a medical illness or not. But let's not take up the time with that subject.
All right. Well, I guess I was thinking, I've known people who are literally crazy and think there are bugs crawling around in their brain, and it ain't no, well, and I haven't read all of Saws, so. But anyway, I've known people who are actually completely crazy, but I would still draw a pretty firm distinction between that and anything like what we're talking about here. That's the point, is that they're basically just trying to smear this guy out of his own mind, you know?
Well, to paraphrase something Tom once said, I'm not saying people aren't crazy. I'm saying they're not mentally ill. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay, well, that's fair enough, too. And again, that is an entire other discussion and all that. And I'm sure that I would agree with a whole hell of a lot of what that guy wrote if I ever sat down and read it. But anyway.
Yeah, look, the interesting thing about Bergdahl is...
I'm more talking about the media's treatment of the situation, you know.
Well, that's right, but more and more stuff comes out every day. I mean, we learned yesterday for the first time, and this was a sort of a reversal of things this was in the Times, New York Times, but it was a reversal of things the Times had reported earlier, is that they've gotten a hold of a classified report about Bergdahl. And it turned out that he had left his outpost a couple of other times and returned. Earlier, there was a report that there was a letter. He left a letter in his tent or whatever on his bed saying, "I'm deserting." But now that's not mentioned in this classified report. So now that's in doubt. We don't really know. I'm not defending the guy one way or the other. I mean, I'm defending his crisis of confidence in the war. I wish he had discovered that before he ever left or joined up.
Right.
But I'm not defending any particular course of conduct he took, but I think we need to wait, and like everyone else, people are beginning to say, we need to wait and see what exactly happened. It's not really clear. If he wandered off a couple times and then came back, how do we know he wasn't planning to come back this time but got caught by the Taliban? I mean, so we don't know.
Right.
It's hard to comment when we really don't know what the facts are.
Sure. Well, and that's the whole thing, though. The real point being, and, you know, today is the anniversary of D-Day, right? So it's sort of, you know, back where we were talking about collateral damage and this and that. If you were a soldier in the army conscripted into the Great Crusade against the Nazis and your job was killing the Wehrmacht on the battlefield, you might even feel 1% sad that they're a bunch of German conscripts too. But you know what? You're wearing gray and you're on this battlefield and I'm going to shoot your ass. And even through the horror of that, you could still see how someone could rationalize what was being done in fighting that war. But that is not at all what we're talking about here. We're talking about a war that was won in the autumn of 2001. And ever since then, it's been a brutal occupation and every bit of collateral damage, so-called collateral damage, is basically all the damage is to innocents at this point. And of course, they lost anyway, right? After all of this, the Taliban's coming back to power as soon as America's gone. Give them, you know, 2.5 months after, you know, 6 weeks or 2.5 months or something after the final end of the American occupation of the drones and the rest, and they'll be back in power in Kabul. And anyway, so, you know, no wonder that anyone would want to up and quit at some point if they started seeing through this. You know, I interviewed Michael Hastings about his article, The Runaway General, and not about McChrystal and the whole scandal there, but about the actual war, what he actually wrote about the war. And that was that every single man in the army thought that the entire thing was risking their life for nothing. The whole thing was a big, stupid joke. Counterinsurgency, where they're supposed to stand around now like traffic cops and just tell Afghans that, oh, we love you all day, and build them a whole new government out of whole cloth and appoint all their new technocrats, a government in a box and all this crap, while they're getting shot to death and their best friends are getting shot to death. And that's the joke he described in his letters back home, and now we're out of time, and we'll be right back with Sheldon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. All right, I was just talking with Norman Solomon. I'm working on lining up an interview with him later about this great new project that they're doing. Dan Ellsberg did a 3-minute video pitch about it, and they're trying to make it so easy for government officials to anonymously upload documents in a way where they don't have to come forward like Snowden. They can get away with it. And the heroic Dan Ellsberg is leading the charge on that, and Norman Solomon is working on it with him, the director of War Made Easy. So that should be coming up here in just a little while. Now, I'm talking with Sheldon Richman, and I'm more talking at him than interviewing him, and I'm sorry for that. But anyway, so this is the point. Bergdahl's crisis of conscience came in the middle of, regardless of exactly what he did about it, came in the middle of a hopeless, ridiculous tragedy farce of a war in Afghanistan. You know, years, 8 years after the damn thing should have been over, if it ever should have been started in the first place. And so that's where your first article, Sheldon, really ends, about Sergeant Bergdahl and the fog of war, and then picks up again in your next article, which is up there today. You heard the Goal is Freedom article for Friday at FFF.org. The disaster that is U.S. foreign policy. So now I'll be quiet and let you explain what you mean to the people.
Well, I think in the larger scheme of things, the Bergdahl matter is a sideshow. I mean, each side now can use it. And when I say each side, I mean the conservatives and the Obamaites, progressives, or whatever you want to call them. I haven't given up the word liberal, so I don't call them liberals. You know, they can fight over him, but they all share the same premises, namely that the war in Afghanistan was a war of necessity. That's how they put it. Obama says that, too. And that it was right to fight it, and that it was a good cause, and then they have differences over how and when it should end, but otherwise they share the premises. And so I was questioning those premises. By the way, on one more thing on Bergdahl, if you look at an article today by Amy Goodman at I believe it was Truth Dig. I don't know if it was today, but I read it today, just in the last couple of days. She quotes from some of Bergdahl's colleagues. From the documentary that was done about their unit by the journalist at The Guardian. And others than Bergdahl were questioning the war. Now, they didn't leave their posts, but they were saying, all we're doing is screwing these people. First, the Russians screwed them. Now we're screwing them. We did the same thing in Iraq. I mean, if Bergdahl had been saying these things, we'd see it all over the media and all over Fox News. But his own colleagues were saying something very similar. So anyway, my point is that the main people who are having this brouhaha over Bergdahl share the premises that the war on terror is the right thing to do. I mean, Obama may not be calling it that, but he's not really questioning it, certainly not deeply. And my point, and it's a point I've made before, it's a point you've made and your guests have repeatedly made, is the war on terror was the result of misconceiving the causes of Americans hit by Al-Qaeda on 9/11 and previously. In other words, they misconceived the causes, and therefore their response to it was wrong. They acted like it was an out of the blue, unprovoked attack, that it was, like Bush said, it was an attack on our freedom or our liberty or our pornography or our democracy, choose it, whichever one you want. But anything but what it really was, namely an attack on U.S. foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East and other parts of the Muslim world. I mean, it's something that Michael Shorter was telling you just the other day, and Phil Giraldi and other people. So I just tried to reinforce that. I quoted Bin Laden on things you've quoted from him before about how the whole strategy was to draw the U.S. into Afghanistan and the Middle East deeper and deeper to bleed and bankrupt the U.S. And that, you know, he ended up getting America exactly where he wanted it. So that's what I tried to lay out.
Yeah, well, and I think you did a pretty damn good job of it, too. And, you know, what's funny about all this, of course, is the context of this is that the American people, if they don't agree with you on all the fine points of the causes and results of terrorism and this and that, they're still just over it. They don't want anything to do with any foreign policy, anything, if only just because they don't want to have to pay attention to it, because they're having a hard enough time just living their own life and that kind of thing. And so in the polls, even the Washington Post and the Newsweek and the Gallup and the Wall Street Journal and the everything, Afghanistan is at least arguably the least popular war in all of American history right now. And yet it's hardly an emergency in the mind of the people, apparently, to end it. It's not their focus, you know, that people protest about, even though it's the worst, one of the worst injustices that our government's carrying out on the face of the planet. But, you know, in essence, when it comes down to you saying, hey, so enough is enough, everybody agrees with you. More than agreed about Vietnam or any other catastrophe in American history. And and yet, we still go on. And this, your quote in here, I just love this thing where you quote a liberal on MSNBC or a progressive on MSNBC saying, hey, the war in Afghanistan will be over in a matter of years.
This was Sam Stein, who said it without any sense of irony whatsoever. If you can, I don't know if it's online, I assume it is. This was on the Morning Joe show the other morning, and they were talking about you know, about the giving up of the five Taliban, and Stein was saying something. He was saying, well, this is what always happens at the end of a war. You know, the POWs get exchanged. And Scarborough was saying, yeah, but this war's not over. And that's when Stein said, yeah, but it's going to be over in a matter of years. You could say that about any war, right? On the first day of it, you can say, well, it's going to be over in a matter of years.
Well, they're saying they're going to keep...
They have a really... And don't forget, with Obama, they're going to be military personnel there into 2016. And what is it going to be, about 10,000 of them through 2015? So this is not over, and yet things aren't going to look any different when they finally do leave. So why not just leave today?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing too. Is, you know, when they do it that way, that means they'll have to pull the very last troop out right during the Hillary versus Jeb election of 2016, which, you know, raises all kinds of questions of whether that'll happen at all and what their positions will be in insisting that troops stay. And, of course, Obama's already signed an agreement with Karzai to stay till 2024. So they might want to not talk about that in the news this week, but I do.
You know? That's under a cloud because Karzai hasn't signed that, right? Karzai's leaving it to his successor.
Well, I mean, this was 2 years ago, actually, when they signed that. So this deal didn't actually include an immunity deal for the troops to stay because it wasn't that in-depth of an agreement. But it did say that, in principle, yes, the U.S. will be there till at least 2024. So,
well...
And I guess it depends whether CIA can get Abdullah Abdullah in there and how that all works out with the new so-called regime anyway.
You know, to step back from this a second, given how recently the Soviet Union had to turn around and leave Afghanistan, it really makes you wonder what the U.S. policymakers had in mind when they decided to go into Afghanistan. Because why didn't they know they were going to get bogged down? I mean, what were they, you know, what were they thinking? I mean, I just wish I could somehow get inside their heads just for a moment, because you have to wonder, what did they think they were going to do? You know, Britain had gone to war in Afghanistan a couple of times, then the Soviet Union, and it never worked out for them. It's not a place you can tame. It's not really a country. You know, it's a lot of clans and tribes and warlords and after the horror of the decade that the Soviets were there, you had almost a decade of open civil war among various warlords. And then the Taliban came along. And at first, probably people were very relieved that the Taliban was imposing order and stopping all this open warfare among various warlords. But of course, that came with a very high price. The Taliban was, you know, horribly theocratic and the worst form is of Islam. And so people, I'm sure, came to regret that. But then the U.S. came in and then the killing starts all over again. So let's leave those people alone. I mean, we're not helping them.
Yeah, it's all the killing without any of the stability. Because that is how it was, where the Taliban's going to come and the child molester in your neighborhood, they're going to throw him down the well. And so, no fair trial for him. They might just, that was the way that they did things was absolutely hardcore. But then, and it was because of their at least supposed piety that they were not corrupt in the way that the average warlord was corrupt, which is not to say they weren't corrupt at all, but it just meant they didn't just go around on a foot soldier level shaking down and beating and raping and stealing from whoever they met. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that is why they were accepted, even by people who were not Pashtuns in the other parts of the country and all that. But anyway, mm-hmm. Hey, listen, of course, we got this stupid time thing here, but I'd like to talk to you more about the war if you can stay over one more segment, can you?
Can't do it today.
Oh, got to run. All right, well, thanks very much for your time, Sheldon. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott, thank you. Bye.
All right, see you. That's Sheldon Richman, everybody. FFF.org. Check out his new one today. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Well, I did get a hold of Eric Margulies, but I didn't get a hold of Norman Solomon again. But I'm going to get... That's one thing I like about having a 3-hour show now, god dang it. I'm going to get a hold of Solomon. We're going to have a 3-guest show today. By golly. Margulies is coming up. He's going to talk to us about Ukraine and Syria. I think. Mostly. Probably. So that should be good. But for now, I got news to cover, and also I got open phone lines. Someone actually sent me a tweet earlier today, asked if we're going to do open phones. It seems like a good idea for Friday. Some people get off work early, or they're allowed to screw around at work more, or whatever. I don't know. Go ahead, call in if you want. We went ahead and ditched the 800 number, because it cost too damn much. Although, I should probably put that back. To encourage landline use, and that kind of thing, you know? But anyway... I could get a Skype number, too, so you could call in. Yeah, except then they don't have the ability to put enough people on hold at the same time. That's no good. Anyway, how about you call? 512-271-4836. That's 512-271-4836. And if you can get to the IRC free node chat room from wherever you are, then I'll paste it in there for you there. Hey, yeah, wait a minute. How come I can get to the chat room page when the rest of the site is down? Does that sound right to you? Wait a minute. Maybe the site is up. Having problems with the website today. There it goes. Hey, it's back up again. Very nice. Website fixed. Gotta tweet that, right? Hey, I'm Scott, and this is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I guess I should put /listen, in case anybody wants to listen, and I'm live right now, you know? All right. So there you go. There's the number, 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Ask me questions or accuse me of things or talk about whatever you want. Of course, the subject is the World Empire. And whatever other libertarian issues, police state issues, Guantanamo issues. You want to talk about this Bergdahl thing that the Republicans are all upset about or whatever it is your thing. Come on in. 512-271-4836. And so there's that. And so on the point of the low morale of the American soldiers surging in Afghanistan. It certainly was not just Bo Bergdahl. Sheldon mentioned an Amy Goodman piece where she mentioned a documentary about this. And I quoted someone referring to that, I think the same documentary before, where these guys were going out on patrol in their baseball caps, as they put it, instead of their helmets, where they're just so far past giving a crap and there was no one in charge. And as Bergdahl put it in his letters quoted by Michael Hastings, He said, the only good people here who are serious about their business and trying to do the right thing at all are a few sergeants, and all of them are getting out and are telling me to get out as fast as I can. And everyone else is some kind of, you know, suck up or kick down or meathead or whatever, you know, someone so jerky. They couldn't possibly be accomplishing the mission described that they're supposed to just love the Afghans to death and just clear hold and build them a whole new society. That's not my language. That's what Chad, was it Chad? No, that's a different... That's a different guy altogether. John Nagle at the Center for a New American Security. That's the Democrats' so-called centrist, but just as bad as the neocons' think tank that they built, you know, to be the Democrats' complement to the Project for a New American Century, basically, to pass around a bunch of piles of papers and pretend like this thing was legitimate. We are going to change their entire society. Afghanistan. Yes, they'll celebrate all new and different holidays from now on. They'll love, I was going to say the white man, but really the Mexicans and the blacks that the white man sends over there to go and occupy their country. Certainly disproportionately, it's poor and minorities who... fill out the ranks of the U.S. Army now. But, oh, they'll be forever thankful for the Americans coming with their high explosives to change their entire society, to give them a government in a box, to clear hold and build them right out of whatever century they're living on in and into ours. Because, you know, America's got so much going for it right now for everybody else to emulate. You could see why we got to force them at gunpoint to want to emulate us. Emulate us, I said. Okay. Don't shoot. But otherwise, the war in Afghanistan is so far beyond hopeless, just forget about it. And you know what? If you're one of those who just insisted so bad before, hey, that was a long time ago. Go ahead and admit now you were wrong. It won't hurt quite as bad as it used to would have hurt to admit how wrong you were. The whole war was the wrong, stupid, evil project in the whole wide world. Although, what the f- you're going to put Hamid Karzai and his CIA heroin dealer brother in charge of what? I mean, according to Michael Hastings' piece, The Runaway General, Hastings' men, McChrystal's men, McChrystal and his men, they tried more than anyone else in the history of the war to really engage with Karzai, to really try to implement this ridiculous coin strategy thing as best they could, and it was a joke. Well, hey, we're here to meet with Karzai. We really want to meet with him, and we really want to go and tour around and apologize for some of the babies that we've killed lately. But what's that you say? He's in the back room puking because he's a heroin junkie, and he can't come out into the sunlight? Oh. He wasn't the mayor of Kabul. He's the mayor of his own palace. The leaders of the counterinsurgency implementation under Stanley McChrystal told Michael Hastings, their words, junkie, loser, scumbag, mayor of his palace. Not the capital city at all. He sits at the head of the table at dinner time. Nobody's denying that. I mean, when he can make it to dinner, when he's not stuck in bed sick with heroin junkie disease. But other than that, hyperbole to even call him the mayor of Kabul, they told Michael Hastings. The whole thing was a joke. The average army grunt was supposed to just stand around like, you know, Officer Timson from the Ray Pryor joke, right? I'm just your friendly neighborhood Officer Timson, here to help you and help direct traffic. In other words, stand there and wait to get sniped to death. while the Delta Force and the Navy SEALs go house to house at 3 o'clock in the morning, terrorizing people, killing them, killing their families, killing the neighbors for daring to come outside, and do night raids like the worst horror stories of the worst totalitarian governments in the history of mankind. Yeah, what they do is they come in the night and destroy everyone, the women, the children, the neighbors. Like some story about the Soviet Union. Only instead it's America. Delta Force, night raids, Waco every day. Oh, sorry, Waco raids every night. We love you to death and we're here to clear, hold, and build a government in a box to change your entire society for you in the daytime. Get the F out of here. Anybody who supported that, you're just wrong. You always were wrong. And everyone who knew better than you all along, they were right and they were better people than you. Sorry. Wrong. As wrong as everyone who ever supported Iraq. So, was it smart for Bergdahl to try to walk to China or whatever the hell he was doing? Probably not. But for him to want to refuse to participate anymore is absolutely right. As one guy wrote at Reason, they should make it easier to quit the army. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott. And coming up, Norman Solomon will be on the show. And so will Eric Margulies. Not concurrently, because they're going to be talking about different subjects, you see. I told you I was going to get Norman Solomon. It was just a little tricky, but there you go. So he's going to be on, and Margulies is going to be on, and then, so that will help supplement, you know, my greatness, or, you know, whatever you call it. Okay, so yeah, man, in this segment, we still got 10 minutes. Let's take some calls. I ought to come up with something smart to be like, hey, you know, the question of the day or something like that for you guys to call in and answer and tell me what you think. But how about this? What do you guys think about whatever it is you want to talk about, man? You know, more or less on subject. I'd like to hear from you. I see we got at least one caller online now. Anybody else wants to join in? It's 512-271-4836. That's 512-271-4836. And so there you go. I'm Scott, and you are now on the air with me.
Hey, Scott. It's Fitz. I'm out in the San Francisco area. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for calling in. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Well, I guess just on the topic of the day with Bergdahl, I was just going to say how you know, how just uninformed people are, like McCain and all the other folks there. Where I remember when I first heard about this, when he first wandered off post, and it was in mainstream news that he was that they were like that he clearly like on his own volition left base like that, and then all of a sudden they're acting you're seeing these quotes from McCain and other senators who are saying they can't believe it. They were they were already doing their hero's welcome on the way when the first news came out, and I think Mencken or somebody had said, you're never going to go broke by underestimating Congress. So it's
you got it's that good right.
Inform these people.
I know, and the thing is, I have every reason to resent liberals as much as conservatives, really. But the thing that I'm like Anthony Gregory on this. Both sides are worse than each other in every way. So how do you measure it? So I just flip back and forth as to who annoys me more at any given time, I guess. But the part that just is driving me mad about really conservatism lately and everybody participating in it, is their contempt for even the idea, even the possibility that they would actually try to know what the truth is about any particular subject, any given point of fact. They're just, you know, obviously if they're conservatives, they're going to disagree with me about everything. But they're going to disagree with me now about whether it's possible for man to know truth beyond Republican talking points repeated? I mean, this is driving me crazy. And it's, you just look at the, and this is the one I always talk about, is the Benghazi thing, where the war against Libya is the hugest scandal in the entire world. Obama ought to be impeached, removed, and convicted and buried under the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado for that war against Libya. But then the Republicans and the conservatives who listen to them, they rail all day about one thing that happened there one day. When the conquerors, in their gun-running operation, backing even worse Mujahideen in the next war over, got caught up and stabbed in the back by the crazy Al-Qaeda-ites that they'd been palling around with. And so they'll latch on to one story about one day, completely devoid of context of the entire story, which is a million times worse than just the consequences that blew back that day. And yet, hey, if the Republicans didn't tell me to think it, I guess I never heard of it.
And it's not just gun running, but it's gun running the Al-Qaeda sympathizers there in Syria. I
mean, yeah, right. Yeah, funneling warriors over there.
It's kind of, yeah, I can't wait till October when the movie on the journalist from around here from the San Jose Mercury News, Adams, on that Iran Contra, when that comes out, because I was like, you know, they're just repeating the same thing. Oh, we're such enemies with Iran now, you know, according to them. Of course, we were trading them, so just like they're doing Al Qaeda now, and they never learn.
Right. And you know what? I'm sorry, but your phone's going bad on me, so I'm going to cut you loose now, Fitz. But thanks for calling in, man. Okay. Appreciate it. And you're certainly right about just the unreality of these guys. Very same people who, well, and, you know, when it comes to John McCain, he doesn't even remember what he used to think about anything. He doesn't even know what it is to think a thing other than a talking point. What's today's talking point? Remember when John McCain's real argument was that Iran is training Al-Qaeda, right? Oh, no, Al-Qaeda and Iran are deadly enemies. Oh, I mean, Iran is doing something I don't like. What am I supposed to say, Joe? He whispered to Lieberman. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott, it's Corky. Happy Friday.
Hey, Corky, thanks for calling in. By the way, I got a good question for the day, which is general enough, which you don't have to answer at all. You say whatever you want, but how about this for a question of the day? What do you think about the NSA 1 year out from all the Snowden revelations? But go ahead and say whatever you want.
I'd rather commemorate that than D-Day, to be honest with you.
All right. In fact, well, let me ask you to do me a favor. Talk good and loud, but hold that phone a little bit away from you because your microphone's pretty bad on that thing.
Okay, how's that?
Pretty bad.
A little better?
No, it's really not, but go ahead, man. It's all right.
All right, well, I'll do the best I can here. I just wanted to comment a couple things about these dinners that Putin had where he was left out of the G7. They had the G6, and I guess they had the G1, which I thought was hysterical. And, again, it makes us look like the Monty Python administration with all this stuff going on.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, let's just pretend that Russia's not a major power worthy of equal respect by the leaders of the other major powers. Although, what's funny is they met behind the scenes. I mean, that was confirmed today by the White House that Obama did, you know, meet with Obama Putin. Same damn difference. I'm sorry. I'm gonna cut this mic. Thanks for calling, Corky. Talk to you soon again, dude. But they did meet. So, you know, I don't know. It's too bad there wasn't an open microphone accidentally, at least as far as we know about yet. Wouldn't it be great to be a fly on the wall for that? Hey, can you have a shotgun mic app for your iPhone where somehow it focuses its recording on something really far away and turns it up while keeping the noise really, really low? Someone invent that app and then give me all the money from it. That'd be a great way. Somebody needs to start spying on Obama and Putin. But boy, do I hope. And you know what? I think it's reasonable to expect, in fact, that Obama is saying something to Putin like, look, man, you know how politics are, but don't worry about it. Well, let's more or less have some understanding here, right? I guess he can't go too far, but for Christ's sake, don't let the madmen and the liars and the Republicans dictate America's Ukraine policy. It's bad enough as it is. Anyway, thanks for calling in, both of you guys. It doesn't always work out that well when we do the calls there. Now, someone asked me, too, about when I blame Woodrow Wilson for everything, do I include invading Russia and trying to overthrow the Bolsheviks after accidentally helping the Bolsheviks to come to power? You know what? Good point. I should blame him for that, because that has been, of course, at the root of Russian feelings toward America this whole time. Same thing in the Middle East. You know, Arabs loved the Americans, even though we look just like the English, you know, so to speak. We had declared independence from the English. We were the model until we betrayed them all. Hey, Al Sky here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Happy Friday to you. I hope you're already off work. Hope you don't have to work on Saturdays and Sundays. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. And our next guest on the show today is our good friend Eric Margolies. He is the author of the book War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan and Asia. And he's also the author of American Raj, Liberation or Domination. He's reported on wars all around the world for generations now. And he writes at ericmargolies.com, spelled like Margolis, ericmargolies.com. You can also find him at lourockwell.com and at unz.com. That's UNZ, unz.com. Welcome back, Eric. Thanks for joining us today.
Good as always to be back.
All right, good deal. Very happy to have you here. So, let's talk about what's going on in Ukraine. I guess before we can cover any of the news, you know, maybe this may take the whole first segment. But could you give us a little bit of a thumbnail about, you know, how we got to where we are and what's going on now with the violence in eastern Ukraine?
Well, that's a tall order, Scott.
I know it, but I know you're up to it.
I'll do my best. Look, this thing, Ukraine has only been an independent country with one or two little blips historically since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Crimea, part of Ukraine, Crimea was given to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev, who was drunk one night at a dinner party in Kiev in 1954. So the historical background of all this is murky. Suffice it to say that Ukraine is certainly a part of Russia, even though many Ukrainians feel they have a separate and distinct nationality. What happened was this whole business began because the Ukraine has been a failed state since its independence. It's not been able to maintain a successful government that can run the country financially properly. It was ruled by robber barons, known as oligarchs, thugs, criminals, and all kinds of nefarious political groups of the left and the right. Now, last year, the U.S. neocons in the State Department, led by Victoria Nuland, decided they're going to try and overthrow the existing pro-Russian Ukrainian government of Viktor Yanukovych. So the U.S. and George Soros, the multi-million billionaire, poured, according to her, $5 billion into what's called building democracy in Ukraine, but really meant, which meant paying for mobilizing, energizing pro-Western groups. And eventually they overthrew the pro-Russian regime, and the western part of Ukraine has now come under a new government, apparently designed by the United States. It has a new president just recently. But the eastern part of Ukraine, the lesser part, which the Russians call New Russia, wants to side and join with Russia. So the U.S. coup attempt in Kiev, successful, really triggered this whole crisis. There's fighting now. Ukraine's on the verge of civil war. It's fighting going on as we speak. And what all this has done is to bring the world's two greatest nuclear powers, the United States and Russia, into an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation, which in my view, as I've been writing for years, is not only crazy, but must never, ever have been allowed to happen.
And now, so if you have to line up America's interests in Ukraine in order of importance, and even, I don't know how many you'd number, 1 through 5, 1 through 10, 1 through nothing, what are America's real interests that could possibly motivate the American government to do what you just said, embark on a course of action that has led us to some kind of very serious, I mean, not Cuban Missile Crisis serious yet, but very serious confrontation between the two powers that could kill us all.
That's right, Scott. America has no real major strategic interests in Ukraine, never did. Unlikely to have so in the future, but this is part of America's mission creep into East Europe, where we were not supposed to go, according to our agreements with Mikhail Gorbachev, and yet we have been slowly drawn into the dangerous arena of Eastern Europe and the Baltic. And it's really part, there are a group of neocons in Washington. It was started by, led by Dick Cheney, who want to bring down the Russian Federation. And anything they can do to damage Russia and wreck it as any potential rival to the United States, they're doing. And the best way, the most effective way, is to detach Ukraine from Russia, make sure it never rejoins Russia, and keep undermining Moscow, kicking sand into its face. And we're seeing this happening right now.
Okay, so then, now the Cheneyite doctrine of permanent unipolar hegemony over the planet and all that aside, if we had, I don't know, some kind of pre-Cheneyite semi-decent regular sort of a little bit national interested government, rational, national-interested government officials here, would they have an argument about how important it is that those pipelines that run through Ukraine, that they go this way instead of that way, and maybe the Russians have too much influence over our European friends by way of their pipelines, so we need to find ways to get that oil out of the Caspian Basin? Is there, in other words, is there anything that's even, you know, the shadow of legitimacy going on here, or is it simply, no, just to beat the Russians over the head and try to destroy even what's left of their rump empire?
There's you're quite right, Scott. There's certainly within the power establishment in Washington, there's certainly a concern that Russia be kept relatively weak and that it not be allowed to rebuild its strength. And these pipeline issues are important because they make Europe dependent of up to about 40% for its energy on Russian sources. These pipelines have become like railroads were in the 19th century. They've become these strategic corridors. They've become targets of rivalry. They're very important, but they're not absolutely decisive. And you know, the counter to this argument is let people trade. I was just in Europe and France, and I'm delighted to see Russians there shopping. instead of revving up their tank engines like they used to do, 40,000 tanks pointed at Western Europe. Things have changed, and Russia should be integrated and brought into the West European economy and not isolated like some demon country.
Yeah, you better watch it or Lockheed's going to come after you, talk like that. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I don't even think there's a thing legitimate about American foreign policy anywhere, but I was just trying to, you know, tease out of you whether it really could possibly be, you know, like you could argue from an amoral, you know, pro-government point of view that it is important, never mind exactly what to do about it, but it is important that we are able to continue importing oil from Nigeria, at least for the short term, because we get so much of our daily supply of oil from Nigeria. So, like, you don't have to be a madman Richard Pearl-ite or David Addington-ite or something to call that a national interest. Never mind the prescriptions for intervention or anything, but just to call that something. Whereas it sounds like, you know, like Pat Buchanan said on this show, hey, come on, Ukraine is east of what we ever used to call Eastern Europe, okay? This is just way too far from us to be anything like a legitimate national interest. And, well, and whether the pipelines go here or there may matter in war, but we don't mean to get in a war with Russia anyway, so it doesn't matter at all, that kind of thing.
We can stumble into a war with Russia. This reminds me of 1914 all over again. And look at the – I wrote a column on this survey taken by the Ivy League professors where they found that hardly anyone they questioned could find any place in Ukraine on the map. Right. And yet we're beating the war drums and we're going to fight to our last round of ammo for a country that nobody knows about. It is absolutely crazy. It's worthy of 1984.
All right. Now, well, I know that you're one of these blame America first hippie types, Eric. And so I got to try to come up with the war party's counter argument here. That was a joke, of course. The war party says, no, man, here's what you're overlooking. Putin, totalitarian, fascist, Mussolini monster at best. Maybe Stalin, and he means to recreate the Soviet Empire, and you just want to roll over for him.
Well, I've been writing for the last, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that it would eventually be reconstituted, if not in whole, at least in part. Putin said that the collapse of the USSR was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. He's very clear on this, and he wants to recreate it. But that's natural behavior for the Russians. If I were a Russian, I would want to do the same thing, too. I would like to see Russia great, powerful again, as it was, not down on its knees, begging like it was under Yeltsin. We have to live with this. But that we can still cooperate with a greater, more powerful Russia. In fact, I think that our behavior, our American behavior, has not been exemplary since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the fact that we see in retrospect that the Soviet Union had a kind of restraining effect on our behavior, which is now completely lacking.
Well, but so... would you concede then that NATO expansion has kept Russia out of, you know, anywhere west of Belarus then?
No, I wrote about this extensively when it was happening in the early 90s. And I said that it would be dead wrong for NATO to expand further eastward. So I cited Frederick the Great's dictum, he who defends everything defends nothing, that NATO would never have the military power to defend all the areas, the Baltic, for example, Romania, Bulgaria, Georgia, for God's sakes, Azerbaijan, into which it was pushing its influence, couldn't defend them. So what it was doing was creating an area of dangerous instability that it had enough influence to create a crisis with Russia, but not enough to protect these areas against the Russian attack. And we were provoking Russia. I said the answer we needed was a sort of a big DMZ, a demilitarized zone, a neutral zone, that all the areas in Eastern Europe should have been put into a neutral zone, made them military free, and let the U.S. and Russia agree both to keep their hands off.
Yep. All right. Well, now, so ever since, I guess there's been a new government since February, the Putsch government there in Kiev. And now they've had an election, and the Chocolate King has won. And I'm sorry that I missed and did not keep close enough track as to whether he's exactly been sworn in yet or what. But anyway, he's one of these oligarchs. And so I don't know if this is still the last regime or the new one incoming, but the government in Kiev, its military, has been attacking the East and seemingly exaggerating their casualty, you know, their body counts that they had achieved, but still apparently only killed innocent people, and including with airstrikes. And it sort of seemed like a big escalation, but to what end? Because they don't seem to really have the military might to really enforce their monopoly power on the East. It's sort of like a civil war where nobody's really even got an army to march anywhere, but everybody is just, you know, well, it seems more like it's Kiev and their guys are the aggressors. They just seem to keep picking the fight and making it worse and worse, but to what end?
Well, it's extremely dangerous. The Kievian military forces were weak. They're being beefed up by the U.S. and its allies. Who do you think is paying for them? Ukraine was bankrupt, totally deadbeat bankrupt. The U.S. is lending, and through its World Bank or IMF, lending them Kiev billions of dollars, which we'll never see back. And it is sending in military equipment, military supplies. The Poles are involved behind the scenes training Ukrainian military forces. So there is a quiet but very real movement to beef it up. And when the Ukrainian Air Force attacks eastern, you know, near the Russian border, the Russians know that NATO is paying and the U.S. are paying for these flights and these attacks. And it's dangerous. And I just wonder how long President Putin's patience is going to hold out. You know, he's being demanded that he declare a no-fly zone over eastern Ukraine and let the Red Air Force defend the skies there.
Oh, man.
It's a very real possibility.
Well, you know, and everybody, please take Eric Margolis seriously. He's the first one that I heard, other than my own brain, saying, yeah, but then what? For example, what are the eastern Ukrainians going to do if America is successful in overthrowing the government in Kiev? You know, like, this is before the coup of the 22nd even happened. Was, hey, you know, it's a pretty divided country, and the people in the East, they're not liable to just sit still for this. And so now here we are with them not sitting still for this. And on we go. And on warns Eric Margolis of the possible consequences. And you know what? I mean, I don't know. When anybody says, hey, this reminds me of the setup right before World War I, I don't know if anything quite reminds me of the setup of World War I. I don't know if I'd take anybody seriously when they say that, except when you say it, Eric. And then I think, wait a minute. Go over that again for me about how, because of course that, for people not that versed, or even, you know, if they're government school educated, that's the one that everyone agrees was the gigantic stupid thing that all the major powers blundered into that they never meant to turn into the horrible thing that it turned into. And if they could have all taken it back, they would have, or just blamed Germany, etc.
One of the stupidest things in all of man's history. I have a Swiss university degree in this the lead up, the diplomatic lead up to the war, World War
One.
So I makes my hair stand on end when I see the stupidity and the ignorance of what we're doing now, most of which is for domestic political consumption. I show you these war hawks on the Republican far right couldn't find Ukraine on a map either if their lives depended on it.
All right, now let's talk about H-bombs. Daniel Ellsberg likes to point out that, see, if you're going to kill somebody with an H-bomb, what you got to do is you got to use a Nagasaki-type plutonium implosion atom bomb as the percussion cap to set it off. You have to make it as hot as the sun in order to be able to fuse those hydrogen atoms together and really kill an entire Houston-sized area worth of people all at once. Does that sound about right to you? The kind of danger that we're messing around with? World War One, nothing. Bunch of foot soldiers with bayonets, little bit of chlorine gas.
Well, I remember when we used to hide under our school desks in the 1950s to protect ourselves against a Russian nuclear attack. I never thought we'd be back to that kind of idiocy, but here we are.
I mean, it really is the kind of thing, not exaggeration, where an H-bomb at a few tens of megatons could kill, say, all of Los Angeles, halfway to the Inland Empire or something, right?
I think, I fear we will live to see something like that happen. I don't know where or when, but the very fact that these weapons have been around for 50 years, menacing us, it's a miracle nobody's used one yet.
Yeah, well, and it makes sense that there's a great incentive on all the warlords of the world to sit tight with those because they could die too, and they don't like dying in war anymore, these leaders. It used to be an honorable thing to them, but not so much anymore, I don't think. So as long as they have to save their own skin, it's mutually assured peace for the rest of us kind of thing. However, I remember seeing a mathematician one time on TV say, "Hey, listen, I'm a mathematician. And I'm telling you that it is a mathematical certainty that as long as more than one of these things exists in the world, or as long as even one of them exists, it or they will be used at some point. You know, it's just going to happen. It might be time to start dismantling these things." And, you know, it's funny because I think everybody knows that this is a real problem, but it's sort of like the Afghan War, the least popular war in American history. Still, nobody seems to care. And so, yeah, we'll get around to getting rid of the H-bombs at some point, even though the Cold War with the Soviet Union has been over for a generation. The Cold War with China has been over for two generations now. And yet still we're armed to the teeth with thousands of these things. And it seems like a priority, especially at times like this, when you have the kind of situation we're talking about, where America has a border dispute with Russia about, 4,000 miles east of Maine.
Well, that's right. But I've been saying on your program a number of times, Scott, that my likeliest scenario for a nuclear exchange would be between India and Pakistan, and that might be triggered by a false alarm with their three-minute early warning system. Right. So it could happen. We could have radiation showering down on our heads that might stimulate or prompt some action. You know, even a number of senior officers at the Air Force and in the Pentagon have called for getting rid of nuclear weapons.
Even George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and some of these guys who, you know, don't have anything to lose anymore, whatever, coming out against it, trying to... I'm surprised that they care at all, but anyway. It seems like a big deal. And I have to admit that somewhere in me is a minarchist who, you know, acknowledges the existence of the U.S. government, I guess. But if anything, it should only exist for missions like sending Eric Margolis over there as the special envoy to host. I don't care how many years it takes worth of talks where you don't promise America will do anything, but you get the Indians and the Pakistanis to see eye to eye on Kashmir and on nuclear disarmament. And you have an unlimited budget, Mr. Special Envoy, to get this thing done.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks. I would love to spend the rest of my life in Kashmir.
Yeah, see, there you go. And everybody can get, you know, you pick the very nicest spot over the lake or whatever it is where, you know, get everybody working on this thing. That's a role for America in the world that I would like to see, where it's where diplomats are actually doing diplomacy and trying to create peace.
I would very much like to see that. I'm 100% with you on that. Unfortunately, we haven't been doing it, and the WikiLeaks leaks show that we've been just mixing up in local disputes rather than trying to solve them on a macro level.
Yeah, you know, I have this old clip of William Jennings Bryan, and he's, you know, being mostly genuine about this. It's a little bit dishonest, but he's really mocking the rest of the powers of the earth for being so weighted down with their armaments and breaking their budgets and breaking the wealth of and freedom of their societies. Whereas our government, the role we play, we just go around holding peace conferences. That's all we're about here. And of course, I'm not paraphrasing him exactly, but that's basically his point. And of course, this was pre-World War I, William Jennings Bryan, before everything changed and all of that. But it seems reasonable enough when you have crises like you're talking about, where even just a false alarm, you never know it, that certainly would be, I don't think anybody would disagree with you, is the most likely place for a nuclear confrontation on Earth. At least, all things being equal, maybe not in the middle of an America-Russia crisis like this, but maybe even still during an America-Russia crisis like this, that's the most likely place for this kind of thing to happen. And as Dan Ellsberg likes to point out, and as we've talked about on the show before, that's enough to cause major problems with harvests around the world for a long time, and collateral damage almost unimaginable since the Second World War, just from that limited of a nuclear war between India and Pakistan on the far side of the planet from here.
That nobody can find on the map, too.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but just think of this. President Obama, a sensible, rational man, well-educated, is having dinner with another sensible, very well-educated man, Vladimir Putin. I mean, they're in Paris at the same time yesterday, I think it was, and Obama would not have dinner with Vladimir Putin. I mean, this to me is childish, and it's crazy. Because here we are the closest to a nuclear confrontation with the Russians since, as you mentioned, the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. And yet the president can't talk to President Putin to sit down and say, listen, let's calm this thing down over a bottle of good Burgundy and let's move away from the track that we're heading, which could lead to a war.
You know, I saw a tweet this morning that said that they did talk, so I'm hoping that the conversation went something like, Vladimir, I'm so sorry that I wasn't allowed to eat dinner with you, but really, let's work this out. I mean, Obama, he backs down whenever he said he was going to do the right thing, so maybe he could back down on this too, you know?
Maybe poor President Hollande, who's on a diet after being called a little fat man by his rival Sarkozy, who has been dieting. Well, poor Hollande had to eat two dinners. So, well, first with Obama and then with Putin. It's silly. It's infantile. It's unworthy of great political leaders.
Yeah, well, and like you're saying, incredibly dangerous at a time like this. All right, so I'm already keeping you over, but that's good. So tell me about a little bit, you know, what you think about the future here. I mean, basically, nobody has anywhere to go except sit down at a table and compromise, right?
That is the logical progression.
And my mistake, yeah.
If left alone, this is a question of money, too. The U.S. and the West are funding this whole Ukrainian operation. The minute they cut back on the money, which most of them don't have, by the way, this whole Ukrainian independence thing will evaporate. I have saying from the beginning of the crisis that the answer is partition of Ukraine. Let eastern Ukraine decide its future if it wants to join Russia or go independent. Western Ukraine is obviously inclined towards Europe. Split the country. There's no reason for it to exist. There's no communality of thought in Ukraine. There never has been. It's never really been a real country. And don't get us involved in a nuclear war over this failed state, which really is not loved by any of its inhabitants.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Eric. I sure appreciate it.
Cheers, Scott. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. That's the great Eric Margulies. EricMargulies.com. The books are War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Isn't that kind of weird? Wait, it starts with the lead there? Anyway. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I got Norman Solomon on the line. He's the guy that directed that great documentary, War Made Easy, which, man, has he got some great clips in there, and I hope he doesn't sue me for pirating them from him all the time. The movie tone news of the Gulf of Tonkin attack being announced and this kind of stuff, hilarious. The babies all in incubators footage. And all the rest. War Made Easy, Norman Solomon. And so then there's this brand new thing called exposefacts.org. And if you go to the blog at antiwar.com, you can read about it. And you can also watch this video by Daniel Ellsberg, the heroic liberator of the Pentagon Papers, introducing this. And this is, as Dan has been saying on my show since 2005, he's been calling for government whistleblowers to come forward to expose wrongdoing surrounding the Iraq war and the rest of it this whole time. And this is just a continuation of that same project, only now better. It's exposefacts.org, and Norman is also helping on the board of this project here. So welcome to the show, Norman. How are you doing?
Hi, thanks, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Been way too long since we spoke. Good to have you here. So tell us everything that you can, everything that we need to know about exposefacts.org.
Well, I can get started anyway, and of course there's a lot more information at exposefacts.org. You quite appropriately referenced Daniel Ellsberg and his appeals for many years now for people with information inside the government and elsewhere, information that the public should know and has a right to know, that information be shared with the public, because you obviously, although from the news media it's not so obvious apparently, that you can't have informed consent of the governed unless the governed have information and are informed. So Daniel Ellsberg's efforts to encourage whistleblowing, I think, are getting a boost. And Daniel Ellsberg was our first advisory board member for exposefacts.org. We launched on Wednesday. We are encouraging people who have information, who are potential whistleblowers, to visit our site and learn how the site operates. We have a secure drop mechanism, and in this day and age, nobody can credibly promise absolute anonymity, but as a journalistic enterprise, exposefacts.org is committed to doing, to the best of our ability, the process of securing anonymity for all sources who seek it. And we're about 48 hours old, and the response has been very strong from a wide range of news media, and we're going to continue our outreach, of course, ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Cool. You know, I talked with Trevor Tim recently, and he talked about some of the places that are beginning to now use SecureDrop, you know, for their own, and he named a few different papers around the country, that kind of thing. But this really is the future, and I guess so. I don't know if a skittish government employee who has evidence of wrongdoing really thought that maybe now was the time to do a little something about it and turn it over to a journalist, and they wanted to use SecureDrop, can you reassure them? Can you explain how SecureDrop works so that maybe they don't have to be Edward Snowden-level computer geniuses to know whether they can trust it or not?
Yes, I mean, the most reliable way is to go to exposefacts.org, because there's a little bit of complexity to it, and we've put a lot of energy to really lay it out in a coherent way to explain. Nobody has any certainty, and we don't know what's going to happen, but we can say that Bruce Schneier and other leading tech experts on the planet have vetted and troubleshot the SecureDrop technology. You mentioned Trevor Tim with the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and they've been very generous in providing the software and training and installation and consultancy in kind for us. And so we have the technological apparatus in place, and equally important, we have the commitment as independent journalists to function as journalists should but rarely do in our society, which is to say that the public has a right to information, and we should not be cowed or intimidated by government authorities who would just assume that some things stay in the dark, even though it is in the public interest for them to come into the light.
Right. Well, and you know, the thing is, I don't know, maybe I always think this, Norman, but it seems like they have just worn it out so bad with the way that they have persecuted journalists and sources lately. And just, of course, you know, with the percentage increase of classification in the last decade, or the era of the terror war increasing by 10 zillion percent or whatever the exact number is, you know, we absolutely need this. They have, I think, discredited their own position. The endless accusations that Snowden really worked for Putin all along and all this kind of crap, it's all ringing hollow. Nobody's really believing it. Everybody is concerned as Snowden about the path that we're headed down here and that kind of thing. So I think that the real definition of journalism, not that it's by and large, you know, what's being practiced in the majority now, but I think it's going to be on a big upswing now. We're gonna have the Bob Woodward effect, right? All the young people inspired by the movie of all the president's men who became journalists, some small percentage of them good ones, you know, in that era. That's going to happen again now from Snowden, Greenwald, and et cetera like that. And now with the technology, it seems like, you know, independent journalists who are willing to do this kind of work and aren't too worried about sucking up and going to, you know, the MSNBC cocktail party or whatever it is.
Well, that's really,
they'll do the work and they'll publish it in ways that where maybe the Washington Post would have sat still or something like that, you know?
Well, that's key, that independent journalists desperately need whistleblowers, and whistleblowers desperately need independent journalists. And without,
what I was trying to say exactly.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, and without both of them working together affirmatively and constructively, then the public is just kept in the dark, and all we're going to get then is the official story. And we know that the official story is routinely partial, it is often mendacious, and it is routinely misleading, and that's how we get dragged into one war after another, how the growing gap between rich and poor is accentuated by Wall Street and banking getting away with murder under the rubric of free enterprise, and on and on. So whether it's climate change or poor people being ripped off by banks and any other number of issues we could talk about, the First Amendment has to be utilized or we will be sunk. And the way to utilize it is to actually take seriously the principle that the press must be independent, and any pressure, corporate or governmental, to force us into a corner must be resisted.
There you go. So, again, back to the actual technique here, this secure drop. You had me at Bruce Schneier there when you said it's been vetted. Again, it's not, nobody can say it's perfect, and the NSA's got a lot of capability and a lot of brilliant mathematicians, and so, you know, nobody can give it 100% assurance, but that's no joke when you have people of that caliber giving this thing the thumbs up to move forward here, and that kind of thing, I think, and I think people will readily agree with that too, so it's worth emphasizing. And this just seems like such a great project. And my understanding of the law, not that that really counts, says that they're not going to be able to do a damn thing to y'all about this either. And so, you know, long live this great project. I sure hope people go to exposefacts.org, help contribute. There's a donate link right there at the top of the page, and you can read all about it and that kind of thing. And if you're a government employee, you should know that that's the only kind of tattletaling that's actually good, is to go ahead and rat on your boss for breaking the law and violating people's rights. Going outside their authority and doing, you know, committing crimes against the Constitution, against what's supposed to be going on around here. Go ahead. It's perfectly good to be a whistleblower. It's the only kind of rat that we all love in this culture. No matter what they say about you, we, the regular people of America, love you and appreciate it. So exposefacts.com to learn all about how you can, you know, install Tor and access this secure drop and figure out a way to provide the proof that you have to journalists who will use it. So thank you so much, Norman, and everybody else involved, and thank you for your time on your show. And we actually have about 20 seconds if you had anything
well,
else to say.
Well, thanks to you,
sorry.
Scott. Thanks to you and to antiwar.com, and look forward to us being in touch.
Great. Talk to you again soon. Appreciate it.
Bye.
That's Norman Solomon, everybody. And watch his documentary, War Made Easy. I bet you can find the whole thing online. It's so good. In fact, I think you can find it at my website in the documentary section there on YouTube or something. Check it out. War Made Easy. It's just great. And we'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm liable to start complaining about the ISIS thing here in a minute. I should have done a better job preparing for the show today. I'll admit that. You know, one thing I meant to cover with Eric and I forgot to say, maybe this is better for my own little rant, is, isn't it something that today's the anniversary of D-Day? At the same time that the USA is backing the right sector group in power in Kiev in this coup in Ukraine. I'm sorry, but man, you know, people go, oh, you know, the election results show that people don't really like these guys and all that. Great. They don't have much of a mandate. So that makes them even worse. Their leader, Yarosh, is now, again, in the new government, sworn in as the head of the National Guard. You know, that's like Rom, the head of the SA, being made the official head of the secret police. Although, you know, without that much power to carry out that much authority, but man, we're talking about real, no-fooling, Hitler-loving Nazis who proudly parade around with Nazi symbols. And who so far have been under instructions to not start persecuting Jews. But how long do you think that's going to last? I mean, these guys are real Hitler-loving Nazis. Go look at Right Sector and show me where that's some kind of smear. Is anybody even trying to defend them? Or they just want to ignore it? And the same for Svoboda, the so-called Freedom Party. They used to be called the Social Nationalists. The Social Nationalists? So in other words, you hate Jews and your hero is Stepan Bandera? Yeah, exactly. They hate Jews and their hero is Stepan Bandera, who worked for Hitler, killing Jews and killing Poles, civilians, in World War II. And that's who America's backing right now on the 70th anniversary of D-Day, or 80th, or whatever the hell it is now? Ever. How could it be? You know? I mean, it makes sense to... I'm not saying it's okay, but I'm saying it makes sense, I guess, for America to back groups like this while they're still occupied by the Soviet Union. They like having right-wing militias behind the lines and don't give a damn who they are. Okay, fine. But just to help spread your empire that doesn't belong a little bit further where it doesn't belong... You're going to hire real, no-fooling, Hitler-loving Nazis. It ain't right, man. And just go put these guys in Google Images, and you'll go, oh, wow, those guys really love Hitler, huh? Yep. There's a BBC interview where the guy says, look, we just want a clean country, okay? Not like Hitler. Well, a little bit like Hitler. a little bit like Hitler. I got it. It'll be a peaceful force march of all your enemies. Okay. This is what the USA is doing now. And I actually think that there's a lot to the Robert Perry Ray McGovern thesis, that a lot of this has to do with picking a fight with Russia just to try to help screw up any cooperation with them on the issue that matters to Israel most, Iran. Man... God, I hate how true that rings to me, that they would go so far. I mean, not that they don't have their own, you know, completely perverted and twisted so-called interests and intervention in Ukraine and doing as many color revolutions as it takes there to get what they want. Eric Margulies is absolutely right, of course. They want a color-coded revolution in Moscow as soon as possible, too. They'd like to take Russia into smaller pieces starting yesterday. If they can. But what really matters to Benjamin Netanyahu? Because what matters to Benjamin Netanyahu is what matters to the neoconservative movement in America. And the answer to that is Iran. Why are we back in the Mujahideen? The Al-Qaeda suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, torturer, crucifixion practicing lunatics in Syria right now? Weaken Iran. Because that's what Israel wants. And here Obama's trying to go ahead, half trying to pass a nuclear deal with Iran right now, to get a final nuclear deal with Iran to put that issue to bed as the biggest fake outstanding Cold War causing issue between our country and theirs, our government and theirs. At the same time, he's willing to back Al-Qaeda suicide bomber kooks in Syria. And by the way, I didn't hallucinate it, although I didn't pay close enough attention and look, but then I saw someone else actually pulled the exact quote. Oh, you know what it was? It was Leslie Gelb, the guy that was the exact, like the evil twin of Daniel Ellsberg, who helped him write the Pentagon Papers and then played along with the state ever since then. Former president of the Council on Foreign Relations and everything. But Leslie Gelb noted that, and somebody retweeted or something, that, what was it? That Obama had mentioned, in fact, I'm not sure the exact words, what was the Obama quote and what was the Gelb quote, but anyway, it was at least a hint that Obama's ready to sidle back up to Assad, and, you know, in the name of creating this third force of moderates, but really, he's ready to spread the terror war to Syria. They've done such a good job of building up ISIS and al-Nusra into a real threat, these last few years, that now they're ready to unleash the drones. Now they're ready to unleash more intervention. Last summer, we were to be Al-Qaeda's Air Force. Now we're sending the Air Force after Al-Qaeda. Said Obama in his speech, which is actually not the same thing as activity. He also said he's doubling down, tripling down on backing the moderate rebels against Assad. And that just still means, in essence, al-Nusra and ISIS, because it's their war. There are no real moderates, not that are doing any major percentage of fighting or stand to gain any degree of power if the Assad government was ever to fall. So, who knows what these guys are doing? Splitting the difference usually isn't much better than just going all out with whatever horrible thing you want to do. All right, anybody wants to call in the show? Still got a couple more segments coming up after this break. The number's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And somebody asked, oh, how does Scott Horton pay his bills? And it's a fair question from someone who's just on a truther disagreement witch hunt. No one's allowed to not be a truther. Everyone secretly agrees with every truther about everything, but they're just bribed, corrupt, evil, or cowardly, and therefore won't admit it. That is what every truther believes about everyone who's not one. So, of course, I'm corrupt, and yet I'm sponsored by Jacob Hornberger, who's more of a truther than me. I'm sponsored by Phil Giraldi, who, hey, he's a former CIA officer, as I tell you every time I introduce him on this show. He's a former CIA officer. He runs Council for the National Interest, who sponsors this show. He's more of a truther than me. You can find it in the archives where we talk about it. I'm sponsored, well, not sponsored by, but I do some side part-time work for Lou Rockwell, more of a truther than me. And then I agree 100% with Eric Garris at antiwar.com about 9/11, and so we're the exact same level of truther there. And so, of course, there are no interests pulling me any direction for or against that narrative or any other. Give me a break. People like the show, they can support it. If not, they can suck it. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. Well, apparently the CIA has a Twitter account, so everybody's making fun of them. Pretty sure the CIA follows more than 25 people, says this guy. That's a pretty safe bet. They got the ghost Twitter, man. They follow you, but without the button turning blue. I don't know. You know what? I was shortened by the time limit there. I should finish what I was saying, which is that in case there's any confusion. I was, but am no longer sponsored by the 10th Amendment Center, but I keep running those ads anyway because I think it's great, and I have no idea what their opinion is about really anything other than I think that they mostly agree with me about stuff. I've never felt the slightest bit of pressure by them to believe anything or say anything or refrain from saying anything. Thank you. And the same goes for libertystickers.com, which pays me a pittance, which I invented in the first place, and which, you know, Rick, I think, mostly asked me what I think about that stuff. And so there's that. And then wallstreetwindow.com, Mike Swanson, I would put him in the same category with Eric Garris, where we're basically of one mind about that issue and pretty much every other damn thing. And, you know, it's interesting that despite even the worst warmongers and whoever, the only people who ever accuse me of being dishonest or bribed or too afraid to tell the real truth about how mean the government is or anything like that is 9/11 truthers. They're the only ones ever. Even the most evil warmongers can tell that I mean what I say. What the hell am I doing? What amounts to, like, not even pirate radio anymore for a living? If it's just because it's, I don't know, making me rich and not because it's what I'm hell-bent on. That's the only thing I have going for me. I don't have an advanced degree. I don't even have an associate's degree. The only thing I have going for me is that everybody knows that I mean what I say, even if I'm wrong. But oh no, you secretly know there must have been 10 million bombs in each tower. Otherwise, the free fall speed, dude, and derp da derp da derp. Same cherry-picked, not even half-truth nonsense for more than a decade now, and still not a compelling narrative out of any of these guys. Not yet. About who put the bombs in the towers, how they made them go off, how they faked the holograms of the airplanes that they say the holograms hit the buildings, not real planes, and whatever. It's all stupid. And if you had anything credible at all, it would be, oh, my wife's documentary. Well, at least she helped make it. It's called 9/11 Press for Truth. There's some important points for you. And there are a couple of follow-ups to that, too, which she wasn't involved in, but still, otherwise it was mostly the same people, I believe. Ray Nowosowski, or I don't know how you say it, and a couple others. I ate dinner with him one time. Nice guy. And they focused very closely on what the CIA did not tell Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar in the White House, or the FBI or anybody else about the Al-Qaeda guys in the country. And why not? And I gotta tell you, it looks really bad for the CIA. But, come on, these guys are tweeting me. This guy, I shouldn't even be talking about this crap. It just means 10 million more tweets my way. They tweet me this thing. Oh, here's the 9/11 official story. A couple of cavemen did it with magic because of blah, 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 blah. Like the dumbest nonsense kindergarten version of the official story that nobody ever really tried to say. Taking the most extreme, ridiculous. Oh, they're cavemen. They're cavemen. Well, somebody said that, but who exactly said that? Because, of course, Bin Laden and Zawahiri both had advanced degrees. And so did Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib, too. They were graduate students living in Germany. What cavemen? And the whole thing goes on like that. Oh, you're afraid to witness me confront the most retarded and ridiculous and paper-thin of straw men arguments. Oh, God, spare me. Like, I haven't been through this for decades with these idiots. Yeah, you're so right, and yet all you have for your proof are ridiculous YouTube videos and pictures. Well, read Peter Lance and then get back to me. That's who I read. I didn't read the 9/11 Commission report. I read Peter Lance, and I read James Bamford, and I read Lawrence Wright, and I read Peter Bergen, and I read Loretta Napoleone. And that's how I know most of the, you know, the background of most of what I know about these guys. Oh, and I've read Michael Scheuer, too. And if you think Michael Scheuer is a liar, you are beyond help or hope, okay? He may be wrong about a lot, but if he's dishonest, then what a world I live in. Because here seems like a guy who is just dying in every circumstance to tell you exactly what he thinks, no matter how much you hate it. And of course, he's not confronted with the truth or stuff often. And if you, I actually saw a video of him confronted with truth or stuff the other day, and he was going, well, you know, I can see why you think that, but the way I look at it is more like this. He's not there to debunk or anything. He's just saying, well, you know what I believe is, you know. But here's the guy who's the world's greatest expert on this. And I'm being told, oh, yeah, that Michael Scheuer, he's pathetic for thinking that Al-Qaeda is anything but a CIA plot. Yeah, because what would a CIA officer know about whether or not Al-Qaeda is a CIA plot or not? And then, okay, now back to how America and the CIA are backing Al-Qaeda in Syria right now, which has absolutely nothing to do with what happened on 9/11, obviously. And in fact, for anyone who would dare to use the word control to describe America and its relationship with Al-Qaeda in Syria, you got it backwards, if anything. To quote Sheldon Richmond, quoting the late, great, heroic Jacob Huber, Jeff Huber, pardon me, I'm reading and talking and doing all these things at the same time. He quotes Huber here, a quote that I forwarded. Dead or alive, Osama bin Laden is the greatest strategist in the history of human conflict. With no Navy or Air Force or anything that resembles a formal army, he's managed to whip the world's mightiest nation like a rented camel. Our economy is shot, the best-trained, best-equipped military in history has been proven impotent, and our moral standing in the world has gone through the sub-basement, etc., etc., etc. Radicalize an entire generation of, fighting-aged Sunni males from, Yemen to the Mediterranean Sea, he could have mentioned. Force the debasement of all the local currencies of the region as they try to keep up with America's inflation because we are the dollar standard, and help destabilize all our sock puppet dictatorships that help provoke these guys in the first place, etc. And so, yeah, do the Americans think that they're clever as hell in using Bandar and using the Saudis to send a bunch of Al-Qaedaites to go and fight in Syria? Yes, they think they're smart, just like always. But you think that means that, what, the CIA can blow a dog whistle and these people will do as they're told? They'll do as they're told as long as it's what they want to do anyway. There is no army here that's been raised. I mean, they may be mercs, but so then they're killing either directly for money, or much more likely because the head of their local mosque told them to go, and they were recruited by probably, you know, the intelligence services in Saudi. But you got Libyans, as we talked about with Sheldon. Was it with Sheldon it was with Margulies. Wait, was it with Sheldon or Margulies? Talked about the joke of Benghazi. Oh, it was with Sheldon. The joke of Benghazi, where they get all upset about Benghazi and the blowback, but not about the war or the actual CIA mission to funnel guns and Mujahideen to go fight in Syria. Which is the hugest scandal of all. They talk for years now. It's the halfway through 2014. And they talk about, oh yeah, we're back in the moderates. We're back in the moderates. When the whole time everyone knows that this war belongs to al-Nusra and ISIS. And any so-called free Syrian army or group of so-called moderates has turned out to be either not an army or not a group of moderates. The Northern Storm Brigade, McCain's friends, yeah, they're veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they bragged about it on video to Time Magazine. So much for that. The Al-Farouk Brigade, they said, you know what, we don't want some kind of harsh bin Ladenite, Islamist law, Zarqawiite tyranny kind of thing. We ought to hold elections and recognize that this is a multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian state. Oh yeah, it was their leader that was on video eating the guy's heart, eating the dead soldier's heart. They're very moderate, the pro-free election Al-Farouk Brigade. These are the moderates in the Syria war. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. You know, if I was to answer the accusation posing as a question accurately, the real answer is I don't pay my bills. I pay the rent only today's the 6th. So does that count as paying the rent? I plan on being able, I hope to be able to get the rest of it together this afternoon. And I pay the gas bill and the electricity because or else no show at all. Otherwise, pay my bills. Are you kidding me? My bills are sitting in a pile on my desk over there, unopened. I'm filthy rich. They're paying me to lie and pretend I don't agree with every idiot about every stupid thing he believes. Did you hear the news? My horrible conflict of interest. I make almost $1,000 a month from antiwar.com. Whose editorial director thinks that the Israelis at least knew everything about it. If they weren't behind it. But oh yeah, that's a lot of pressure on me to not be a truther. Anyway, sorry. What a waste of time. But, well, it's a waste of time only because of who's the stupidity of the people asking the questions. But it is a fair question. For someone who's trying to tell you what to think is true about what's going on in the world, that's, you know, it's good to question that. I'm paid by the people that you hear advertise on the show. Oh, plus the go-kart guys who advertise just a web ad and web dev geeks. They don't do commercials on the show, but they do web ads. So I should include them too. I'm pretty sure that these people that advertise on the show advertise because they like what it is that I'm doing and saying, not because they thought, oh, good, I'm going to tell him what to believe now. In fact, I have a new sponsor coming on board. I haven't cut the spot yet, but that's going on this weekend. I got a new sponsor coming on board. It's Roberts and Roberts Investments. You hear them advertised at the top of the hour news there. And that guy, more of a truther than me. So pretty sure there's no pressure from him to not be a truther. And then also I got another new sponsor coming on board, another coffee sponsor, which is cool. And I have no idea what he thinks about this, and I'm pretty sure that he's never even going to try to instruct me what he would have me say about who did the 9/11 attacks. I'll let you know, in fact, if he drops a line and says, I'm not doing this commercial unless you blame it on Brazil or whoever. Or whoever. I'll let you know. Someone tries to buy my silence. No one has ever tried to buy my silence. Mostly because I'm pretty much silent anyway. Nobody listens to me or cares what I say. So, what interest would anyone have in trying to get me to stop saying what I say that nobody hears? That might cause some attention to come my way. I don't know. Not that that's, you know, too stupid for someone to try, but wish they would. All right. And then, so, yeah, that's it. That's all I got to say about that. Isn't it? I think so. Okay. Oh, cash into coins. I'm trying to get them back on board. I have no idea what their opinion is about anything other than I know they like Bitcoins, and they made a business about Bitcoins. I haven't felt any financial pressure from them. I'm trying to, they quit sponsoring the show. I'm trying to get them back. 9/11 has not come up, actually, about whether or not I say what they would have me say about it. And you know what? I'll bet you $1,000,000 it hasn't come up at Cash Into Coins headquarters among them either. This is the first time it's ever come up in anyone's even imagination, actually, in regards to that particular sponsor. Express Coin. It's called Express Coin now. So, same difference, though. I don't mean to use that as a technicality like Donald Rumsfeld to get out of answering a question or anything. It's no off-ramp. All right, this Sunday on Anti-War Radio on KPFK, I'm going to rerun that Eric Margolis interview. It was pretty good and more than half an hour long. So if I just cut some of me out, it'll be 29 minutes and I'll go ahead and it's as good as Margolis. I don't know. Maybe I'll get somebody else on to talk about something else. I guess it depends what happens. It's possible to be a fresh new show for you on a Sunday morning. That's 8:30 in the morning on Sunday, L.A. time. It sounds like a bad time for a show, like it would just be a paid gardening spot or something like that. But actually, it's sort of like the Sunday morning news shows on TV on Pacifica Radio in California, in Southern California. It's kind of been a tradition for a great many years to have these morning news shows. And so that's what people deliberately tune in for and have for generations now, honestly. So it's not that bad of a spot, although 8:30 is a little early for me. But anyway, that's KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and KPFK.org and all of that. Chat room guys are funny. All right. So, what the hell else was I going to talk about, man? I forgot. Oh, I know. I was going to say about World War II. Well, I got to guess a couple of somewhat unrelated sort of things. First of all, I think, for my purposes, the worst part of World War II is... Well, no, that not the worst part. Whatever. The thing I want to mention first is... It's really problematic that Americans are led to believe that America won the war against the German Nazis. And they certainly did help the Soviets win the war, starting with Lend-Lease way back. And the tanks and the trucks really made the difference in turning the tide in favor of the Soviets against the Nazis, I do believe. But still, it was the Russians and the Soviet satellite states, their conquered states and conscripts and whatever, but really it was mostly the Russians who died and killed to win that war. They're saying now, what, 27 million or more even? I guess I'd always heard it was approximately 20 million Russian civilians died in the war against the Nazis. And a great many soldiers as well, millions and millions of soldiers as well. In the war against the Nazis. They're the ones who won the war, and it's not so much, you know, yay communism or any kind of crap like that that I'm pushing, but it's just that, you know, I learned that I had a particularly good social studies teacher in fifth grade, I think. But I think most people don't, and I think they never really are told that. And they're always led to believe that Private Ryan and Tom Hanks were the ones who won that whole war and saved Europe from the Nazis and all of that, but it really wasn't. It was the Reds that defeated the Browns there, the Red and Blacks in the Nazis. And the reason it's a real problem is because Americans have ever since had this ridiculously overblown, completely out of control, out of context, Superman complex about what heroes their grandpas were in the Second World War and how, therefore, every crime that they commit from now on is golden. And every time that they invade and topple a government, massacre people, it's always just like that time that we saved France from the German Nazis. And they all thanked us and waved their multicolored handkerchiefs, and it was the liberation and the... And the myth of the good war fought and won by the United States of America, even against the very quantitatively probably the second worst regime in human history. Qualitatively, it's arguable, I think, against the Nazis is still that it has underlined this myth about the righteousness of American power. And yet, if you just go back and look at the history of that war, as it was told by the Americans fighting it at the time, the people who were making the policy, they entered the war so that they would inherit the world. They let it go on long enough. They wouldn't have to do too much of the fighting. It sure looked like to a lot of people anyway. But their whole idea was, what's the post-war world going to look like? Well, it's going to look like everything is burnt to the ground except the center part of North America, man. So... The European empires and the Asian empires will all fall right into our hands. And that's exactly what happened. America got 2/3 of the world. The Soviets got 1/3. And then China. These are rough proportions, you understand. And then, but America inherited all of the British and French and Dutch and Belgian and Portuguese and whatever empires all across Asia and the Pacific, and it became a neo-colonialism. It wasn't outright colonialism in the old style, but still in the name of the Cold War against the Soviet Union, they really did create a world empire, and the kind of world empire that now, of course, threatens the very basis of our civilization. And based on the myth of the good war, which, you know, this is way too short of a time to really get into. And I had grandfathers that fought in World War II, a grandfather and a great uncle who fought in World War II. You may have too. But when Pat Buchanan titled his book, The Unnecessary War, he was quoting Churchill, saying, you know, we really shouldn't have done that.